This is episode 77 with Andy Malinsky.
Welcome to the As Told by Nomads podcast, where you'll learn how nomads, third culture kids, entrepreneurs, and leaders all over the world embrace their global identity and use their difference to make a difference. And now, having lived on four different continents, here's your host, Tayo Roxon.
Welcome, everybody. Today I have with me Andy Malinsky. And Andy Malinsky is a professor of international management and organizational behavior at Brandeis University, University's International Business School, with a joint appointment in the Department of Psychology. He's also the author of the new book, Global Dexterity, How to Adapt Behavior Across Cultures Without Losing Yourself in the Process. Andy received his PhD in organizational behavior and master's in psychology at Harvard University. Andy's current work focuses on the challenges people face when adapting behavior in foreign cultural settings, as researchers explore the dynamics of psychologically demanding tasks, including necessary evils and organizational change. So I'm pretty excited to have him on the show because that's pretty much in line with all that we talk about at the As Told by Nomads podcast. So welcome, Andy.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here.
Thank you. So you have this book about global dexterity. I have two questions. How did you come up with the term, if you did, and then what is the book about?
Sure. Yeah. No. The book, I came up with the term global dexterity because so much in the world of culture, international business is talked about cultural differences, but I think that the reality on the ground that people struggle with often isn't just understanding intellectually what the differences are. It's being able to adapt and adjust their behavior in light of those differences. So with that in mind, I wanted a title that captured the dynamic aspect of how people need to do global business, and that's where I came up with Global Dexterity. The book's about understanding the challenges of global dexterity and how to overcome the challenges. It's written in a pretty user-friendly format and gives very concrete tips about how anyone, anywhere can learn to adapt and adjust their behavior across cultures without losing themselves in the process, which essentially means by staying authentic, not feeling disingenuous, because I find that in foreign cultures, sure, you can suppress who you are to try to act appropriately, but in the long term, that just doesn't work too well.
No, I agree with that. And I guess one question that will immediately come to mind is, it's when people go from east to west or west to east, where it seems to be completely different, how, you said it's important to remain authentic, how can they remain authentic, keeping gender differences and just, authority differences in mind? How do you think that's something that people can work on? Because I imagine that's something that's difficult.
It is difficult. Not always difficult, by the way, though. In certain cases, it's actually not difficult. Mm-hmm. There are some people who have personalities that aren't typical of what you might expect, right? Yeah, so, okay. For instance, I teach at a business school, international business school, and I've got lots of students, MBA students from Japan, Korea, China, and the stereotype is that they don't speak in class, they might not be very assertive, don't speak up, but I can tell you there are plenty of students who are against the stereotypes.
So, right, okay.
So it's not everyone in every case, but yeah, you're right. I think there are a lot of situations that are very hard to do from east to west, and the core of my book is really about learning to customize and personalize your behavior. And what I mean by that is sort of the idea of like, imagine that you're going to buy some clothes and you buy a pair of pants or a blouse or something at the store. Usually most of us, at least for me, I know I can't just put on that pair of pants and it fits perfectly. I always have to have a tailor adjust it a little bit, right? Make little alterations
right,
so that it feels and fits just right for me. And I feel that that's a good metaphor for what people can do across cultures. They can find a way, oftentimes, they can find a way so that they can be effective in that new setting, even if it's east to west, but still feel authentic. So they can sometimes create almost like a little bit of a blend or a hybrid between who they are, what they value, and what they need to do in a new culture. And if you think really hard about that and you use the tools that I talk about, you can make those blends, you can make those fusions, and it can be much easier than you think.
Yeah, interesting. And are there any tips that you have for something like this? Because I've read some of your articles, I've read a lot of them, and they're really good, by the way. And a lot of what I like about what you do is that you say, imagine a British guy goes to an American environment. So you really paint the picture and you put the paintbrush there so we can visualize this. But I guess what I'm asking is, are there any tips for, say, you're talking about Japanese students, say an international student coming into the United States from Asia or Africa or Europe or another country, and them having to fit into a business setting as opposed to what they would do normally? So that's networking, getting more noticed, making themselves employable in an American setting.
Yeah, so in the book, the framework basically are the tips I kind of arrange in four different stages. Mm-hmm. Like, let's say, and I like to think about it in terms of a situation, because not all situations are the same. You know, some situations you walk into in a new culture actually fit pretty well. Other situations you can really struggle with. So I always base it by situation. But let's say you're caught up on a new situation that's really challenging for you. The first step to me is to learn the rules of the road. Like, how are you actually expected to act in the situation, and how is it different from how you would kind of naturally and comfortably act? And in the book, I have a way of doing that in terms of different dimensions of behavior. So like, how directly am I supposed to act in the situation? How assertively, how much enthusiasm am I supposed to show? And you can pretty easily, I have a chart, and you can pretty easily kind of look at the difference between, you know, your comfort zone, how you'd naturally do it, and how you need to do it in the situation. Sometimes people don't know because they're not familiar with the culture. That's where a mentor comes in, or someone who can kind of help guide you to understand what the norms are and how they might be different from what you're used to. Mm-hmm. And then it comes down to trying to figure out a way to customize, to try to personalize it. So yeah, it's out of your comfort zone to be self-promotional. Let's say you come from India and you need to promote yourself. But are there ways, are there things that you could say, are there little ways that you can kind of alter what you say so that you still kind of toot your own horn a bit in the U.S. setting, but you still also stay deferential? So one example, I know someone who, when he talks in an interview or a networking event about himself, which is really uncomfortable from an Indian perspective, at least from his Indian perspective, what he does is he talks about his own accomplishments, but he always talks about the team as well. Or he talks about his own accomplishments, but he says how proud he is that they actually help the organization. So an American might not immediately think of those things, right? Blending the team and the organization with your own individual accomplishments. But for him, that blend, just sort of like almost like creating fusion cuisine and food, like right. That blend ends up enabling him to be able to promote himself in a way that he wouldn't have otherwise. And then kind of the last part of it is making it into muscle memory. It's sort of like, you know, like sports players do this. You know, you kick a ball, you're Leo Messi and you're trying to learn how to do like a really good free kick. Well, he doesn't just do it once, he practices it time and time again. Or you're a baseball pitcher and you're throwing a ball, you want to get that motion down over and over and over again. It's the same thing with your cultural behavior. You gotta make it your new normal. You gotta practice and practice and practice, and over time it can become more natural to you. So I mean, that's basically like that's the formula, and I find that it's actually pretty successful.
Yeah, no, so observe the environment that you're in, find a cultural mentor, so to speak, and practice, as you know, as this, like you said, you liken it to Lionel Messi, where you hone your craft, the more and more you do it, it becomes part of your muscle memory. And something that I can say you probably agree with is that, you know, making mistakes is part of the process, and it's actually does help you grow. I mean, I can think of a few faux pas that I've had myself, but would you agree that that's part of the process?
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, like I have one of the blogs I've done for Harvard Business Review, I talk about like the idea that, you know, faux pas and mistakes are inevitable, and you kind of have to figure out what your forgiveness strategy is going to be, because it's naive to think that you're not going to make mistakes. The question is how are you judged when you do make them? Okay. So you know, they, of course, they're part of the learning process too, but in terms of like how you're perceived, that's important too. You want to make sure that, you know, that that you kind of find a way to cut yourself slack. Exactly. So when you do make a mistake, hopefully it won't be counted against you, or it will be seen by the other person as sort of a genuine, honest attempt to try to learn the new cultural norms. That's how you want it to be perceived.
Yeah, and the reason I love what you're saying is because you were basically saying fitting in without giving in. You know, you're not giving too much of yourself and losing yourself, but you're also fitting into the environment because you're aware of what's accepted and what's not.
You don't want to give in. It's like, I think it's unrealistic. Like, you know, sometimes people, when they talk about crossing cultures or going into an environment out of the ordinary, like, sometimes you get like two pieces of advice I hear. Like, one extreme advice is like, you know, when in Rome, act like the Romans. Like, you kind of have to adapt exactly what the other group is doing. The other piece of advice at the total other end of the spectrum is, yeah, just be yourself and you'll be fine. You got to just be yourself. I think both of those are naive. I think you need to find a middle ground where you can essentially be yourself or be enough of yourself, but at the same time you're also accommodating to the new setting. Because if you don't hit that middle ground, it's not going to work.
Yeah, no, and that comes with the observation and obviously knowing a lot more about the cultural landscape. The something you said earlier was finding a mentor. You have a piece about how being experienced doesn't automatically make you a great mentor. Can you elaborate on that and talk about maybe a process to find a cultural mentor?
Yeah, I think a lot of times people who are experienced forget, you know, you forget how challenging it was when mm-hmm. you were first learning something. So sometimes very experienced mentors don't have the empathy of a novice. I find that people also sometimes make mistakes when they're trying to find a mentor. They make the mistake between a mentor and a model. Like, a model is where you go into a new setting and you watch how other people do it and then you kind of copy it in a way. Now, those are good, but you have to make sure that you have a bunch of different models so you don't like hone in on just one model, but you see a bunch of models and then you kind of pick and choose and see what fits with you. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. See how they're effective, maybe, but at the same time filter it how it's going to fit with you. I find that finding a mentor, you know, a lot of organizations assign mentors. I often find that can work, but, you know, organically, finding a mentor a little bit more organically maybe creates a better fit.
Yeah, and the organic ways would it be just going out there and talking to the locals, or what would be an organic?
Yeah, like finding, like for instance, I have an American executive who was in Taiwan, and he was for a consumer products company, pretty high level executive, and he wanted a mentor, and he ended up, you know, he took a little bit of time to work on a couple of different project teams, and there ended up being a person from Taiwan who was pretty attuned to the U.S. He had lived in the U.S. for a little bit, and this guy, this executive that I know, ended up just kind of connecting with him, and he didn't sort of, you know, shake hands and say, "Would you be my formal mentor?"
But he
did, like, you know, ask the guy maybe for a drink, or, you know, would you come and chat and ask him some questions, and then the guy was receptive to it, and sort of over time they built this relationship.
Gotcha. Talking with Andy Molinsky here. So part of what you do is you deal with a lot of multinational companies or people that invariably deal with people across different cultures, and I'm curious as to what some of the mistakes you've seen that managers make when doing cross-culture training.
Yeah, it's a good question. One of the biggest mistakes, I think, is sort of what I mentioned at the outset about differences. I think people are obsessed with differences. And I think there are two dangers of that. Well, first of all, by the way, understanding cultural differences is important. I don't want to minimize it, right? But there's two problems with just focusing only on differences. Number one, the real challenge a lot of people have isn't just knowing the differences. It's being able to adjust their behavior in light of those differences. So it misses the whole part about how challenging it can be to act outside your comfort zone. And that usually is a big challenge people face, not just understanding the differences on some intellectual level. Uh-huh. I think the second big mistake about just focusing on differences is that it ignores similarities. And I think that when people are so fixated and oriented on differences, when you think about culture, you immediately think about differences, right?
Yeah.
But the thing is that the way that you create bonds across cultures is often to think about similarities, right? Mm-hmm. You're from Nigeria, right?
Yeah.
You're from Nigeria?
Mm-hmm.
I'm from the U.S., but I love soccer, European football. You might too, and so maybe we bond around that.
That's
a similarity. That's not a difference.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I think it's important. Like, I think a big mistake is to focus solely on differences for the reasons that I just mentioned.
Yeah, a lot of what we talk about at UID is finding your connectors. And for me, like you said, it was I found three. It was sports, geography, and pop culture. I can always my favorite sports are, you know, you mentioned basketball, football. You mentioned football, soccer, I guess, depending on how you call it. So the both types of football, tennis, and basketball. And I can usually find conversations around that. And then if it's not that, I could go to geography, just because I always knew all the countries and capitals. I usually just mentioned cities there, and it somehow makes conversations easier or breaks the ice. Or I could just mention something with pop culture, just with, you know, hey, did you see what happened with, you know, Bieber or something? I don't know. Something like that. And then it always something like that. But like you said, it's at the core, we're all people. Yes, we do have cultural differences, but there are also ways that you can find a way to connect with someone across any culture. If you really, you know, taking what you said earlier about observing culture mentors and just not focusing on just what's different about you. And that, to me, is what I call the Berlin Wall. When people put too much emphasis on the difference, it sends to just make you think one way, this is my way or that way, and then you never really have that collaboration that you want.
Yeah, completely agree with that. Yeah.
Okay. But there are times when, and you talk about cultural differences interfering with your time. What do you mean by that?
That piece came. That was a Harvard Business Review article that I wrote about cultural differences in terms of time and timing, and how some people might treat deadlines very differently, for mm-hmm. instance, or they might treat timeliness in a very different way, like in terms of coming to a meeting or something
right,
like that.
Right.
So you can imagine how frustrating and difficult it can be when people who have a very sort of structured orientation towards time encounter someone who comes from a culture where time is just simply not as important, like the pure focus on time mm-hmm. might not be as important. It's funny, I used to do a exercise in one of my MBA classes where I had people take out a piece of paper and write, you know, what do you do on a typical day? Just a simple question like that. And the Americans, or people from like Germany or Switzerland, would always like write a very linear description of their typical day. Like, I get up at this time, I do this, then this, then this, then this, right? Very linear. And people from other cultures didn't necessarily answer that same general question in a linear description. They might sort of talk about the relationships that they had during that day or the general activities, but without putting a, you know, linear spin on it, like, you know, focusing on, you know, exact constriction of time, this. And so I think that's, you see that a lot in a lot of organizations too. People feel that they have different orientations towards time, and the problem is that, you know, that can create ill will and negative feelings if there's not a way to deal with it. So that's kind of what I meant by that culture impacts so many things. It impacts behavior, it impacts how we express emotions, it impacts how we think, and it can also impact our views of time.
No, and the reason I brought that up is because in Nigeria, and, you know, generally a lot of African countries, we call African time Nigerian time, and that just necessarily means it's later than normal. I know in some South American countries it's the same thing, people come in later, and depending on the country. But as someone who grew up everywhere, I always was taught to come in 5 minutes early, whatever. That's always I've been. And I think that's just because I've always adapted to the American culture, because I was always going to American international school or this type of thing. And it was always interesting when sometimes I go home and I can see my parents sometimes going with the Nigerian time and all that. And then it would get frustrating for me, and I would have to always remind myself that, okay, look at where you are. This is not how it is. And I just adapt. But the reason I wanted to bring that up was because as business professionals, right, and millennials and people in the business setting, how do you plan for meetings in these areas where the time is so in flux?
I know. It's a really good question. I mean, there are a bunch of different ways. It depends if you're, you know, if you're organizing a meeting, you can just, you know, there are cultural norms. People come from different cultures, but you also have organization norms and group norms, right? You can sort of set the norm. I do that every single time I teach an MBA class. I say, listen, you know, my students, I have 75% international students. So, like, you know, seven or eight out of my ten students are from foreign countries with all different conceptions of time. And when I walk into the classroom the first day, I say, listen, guys, you know, I know some of you are from Brazil. I know some of you are from Africa. I know some of you are from, you know, Germany. We're operating on Swiss time in this classroom.
Yeah.
I set the norm. I say, I get that there are cultural differences in time, but you're going to have to adapt. And there are consequences if you don't. And so I think to some degree, managers can do that as well. It makes it more challenging, though, when someone above you, someone who has power above you, has a different orientation towards time, right? You can't exactly tell someone who's got a lot more power than you do how they should spend their time and how timely they should be. And so, you know, that gets pretty frustrating. I can tell you, people in organizations can find that pretty frustrating. You know, sometimes I know one guy who ends up, like, anticipating that someone's going to be late and then creates, like, make sure he has stuff to do, like activities he can do on his computer so that he's actually making use of the time that he feels that he's wasting when someone's much, you know, too late for a meeting. And he anticipates that and builds that into his own schedule. But of course, he's still frustrated by it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I like what you said about setting that standard and norm. It could be, whether it's the email, the communication channel, and be like, we are going to operate on this time, and this is the time that's going to start, and it's no later, not that. And I think that just sets, you know, it just makes them think, okay, fine, if I miss this, I know that this is on me. This is not something that they should have known.
There's a guy I know, professor I know, who actually closes the door. it's like at 9 o'clock, let's say, if the class starts at 9, closes the door at 9, and that's it. Yeah. If you're not there, you're not there.
Sometimes you have to do that. You honestly do. No, okay, so let's say the international students. That's just one thing that they'll deal with. But another thing is, obviously, that as a professor with mainly international students, is fitting in socially. And that's just understanding whatever goes on in the American culture beyond employment. What are some of the difficulties you've noticed with the international students across the board? And how do you usually help them out?
Socially, you know, I don't get to help out as much on the social front. Mm-hmm. I help more on the professional front, but mm-hmm. I think that language ends up being a big issue there. Mm-hmm. In terms of being able to bond across groups, I find that the international students who speak English the best are able to blend across groups more than others, or people who just are more open to it. Right? Okay. Some people feel much more comfortable in their little group. Mm-hmm. But I find that people who are a bit more adventurous and who can speak better English are able to adapt, you know, more successfully and be part of the group. You know, there's some students, not just students, by the way, it's like professionals.
Professionals, yeah.
You know, sometimes when you, like, I remember when I went abroad, I went abroad twice. The second time I went, I said to myself, I am not just going to hang out with Americans. You know, like, I made it an absolute goal that I was going to be able to blend and mix. Mm-hmm. And that happens, that's also true for professionals. Like, oftentimes, you can go to another culture and you can live in a neighborhood or an area or a building or something that's sort of like an expat community, or you can blend more with locals, right? There's all sorts of choices that you make and that you can make, and I find that that's a real individual decision, and you actually, my piece of advice on that is to actually think carefully about what you want to do.
Yeah.
You know, don't let it just happen to you. Think thoughtfully about it.
Okay. Well, one of the really big things, big reasons I like to do what I do with this cultural training is I believe that, you know, in the year 2015, it's the digital age, right? You also have people becoming more and more diverse, whether they know it or not. We have the world is becoming more of a, you know, a global village. And I think it's in order to help build the next set of global leaders, it's becoming increasingly important to understand how to communicate across cultures, whether it's bridging the culture divide or not. I think this manifests themselves in political atmospheres, professional atmospheres, social atmospheres. Do you think that cross-culture training needs to be shifted in order to adapt to the best ways to help bridge culture divide, or do you think that we have a long way to go to get to where we need to be?
You mean in general?
Like in general, yeah.
Training?
Yeah.
I think a lot of times people go for low-hanging fruit with cross-cultural training. So they'll go for the minimal possible. You know, oftentimes, and I've written about this too, and I've seen it in a lot of organizations, they'll go for the quick hit. You know, something that an HR, let's say an executive makes some decision that they need to globalize, and then they might even pass it down the chain to the HR department. And the HR department then oftentimes looks for some sort of package solution, some tiny package solution. And then they'll buy that tiny solution. It might be some sort of computer program that their employees can go on to learn a bit about cultures. And then that's it. And the box is checked. And yes, cultural training has been done. Check. You know, I think that that's not, it's not terrible. It's not bad. But I think in many cases, it's insufficient. Because as I've said, it's not just simply having some simple level of awareness about culture and cultural differences is that's going to make people successful global leaders. I think that's it's a nice first small step, but I think that training needs to be more experiential. It needs to help people learn how to adapt and adjust their behavior across cultures to develop global dexterity, not just global cultural knowledge. So I think that's the next frontier of cross-cultural training.
Gotcha. Yeah, experiential definitely takes it a whole different level, because you get to really feel uncomfortable and feel comfortable, and you also get to hear and experience kind of what it's like in foreign environments without it takes it beyond just a textbook or a computer. So your life, Andy, talk about your background, how you got to be so passionate, how did you get into this field, why traveling, what was the road that led you here?
Yeah, so I went abroad in college. I grew up in the United States. I did not have a multicultural background at all. I was what you'd call a monocultural. I never stepped foot out of the country. When I was in college, I studied in Spain, and it completely opened my eyes to the experience of being in another culture. I guess I was very sensitive to it. And sometimes even one experience, if you sort of really think a lot and leverage that experience and learn a ton from that, it doesn't mean you have to have 15 experiences. You can learn. It's how much you take out of the experiences that you have that matters. And so that really opened my eyes. It made me passionate about culture. I took a bunch of languages in college. After college, I decided I wanted to go back. So I went to France and I worked for a French company. And I had another experience, and that was the one where I decided I absolutely needed to bond with locals. I couldn't hang out with Americans. I had to really bond and create connections across cultures. And from there, I traveled quite a bit in my 20s, I would say, mostly to Europe, Western Europe. Since then, I've now found the opportunity in the United States to do a lot of cross-cultural training. As I said, my world in the United States here, my little world, is very, very international. So I've found almost like a global village where I am. As I've gotten older and I've got kids and stuff, I don't have as many opportunities to live abroad or work abroad necessarily, but I am able, through technology, through the experience of travel, and also mostly through my workplace, to have a tremendously international life and experience even here. So that's really what brought me to this topic and why I'm so passionate about it.
Awesome. Awesome, man. I love that, you had a series of intentional travels there, because you let your curiosity take you to some places, and then you just increased your knowledge in these areas. And the thing about cross-cultural training is that, the more you learn, the more you see that you don't know, but that's part of the process, and that makes it even fun. We're getting ready to wind up soon, but I've got a couple questions here. What would you say about people who want to get into the cross-cultural field? What are some of the steps that they can take to get into this field? And when you answer that, I'll ask the second question.
Yeah, so I think have experiences and be really thoughtful about your experiences. As I said, it doesn't. You don't have to live 15 different places. You just have to be very thoughtful and reflective about your experiences. What's amazing nowadays is that everyone can be an author, everyone can be a videographer, everyone can be a journalist to some degree, right? So the world is open in terms of media and social media. So I think that the barriers to entry are much lower. Now, of course, that means that there are a lot of people out there. But I think that the barriers to entry are much, much, much lower, and really plug away at it. I think there are lots of interesting organizations that exist out there. There are a lot of communities, formal and informal communities. And I think that, you know, just really plugging away, doing smart work, whatever you happen to post or write or do, make it of the highest quality you can, and I think you'll get far.
Okay. And you mentioned digital media. I completely agree. It's made the world a lot flatter. Also allows for a lot of, you know, good and bad things. So yeah. how can one brand themselves, so to speak,
I think that has to be authentic as well. You know, I think that you have to make sure that if you brand your brand has to reflect both the value that you can add to other people, but also something that you actually genuinely know about, right? so there has to be some substance behind it. But I, you know, in terms of branding yourself, I think all the sort of conventional steps apply. You know, do excellent work. If you're going to tweet stuff out, if you're going to post stuff on Facebook, on Instagram, or wherever it is, you want it to be of really high quality, because it's not just getting stuff out there. It's getting stuff out there that's going to last, that's going to have some weight to it, right? That people care about, that people want to pay attention to you and follow. So I really think, in the end, despite all the chatter, despite all the self-promotion, despite all the tweets and the posts and everything, I think quality wins the day.
Yeah, value, promotion. And I mean, that's how I found your work, actually. I was looking for more insights from cross-culture training, and I started reading like 5 of your articles on Harvard. I was like, wait, this is the same person.
So, awesome. All right. Yeah.
No, so I think it's the quality that definitely does, because, you know, it was a search on cross-culture training, managers, and then boom, you know, that happened. So, okay, we like to ask our guests this: how do you use your difference to make a difference?
How do I use my difference to make a difference?
Mm-hmm.
Very good question. I've never been asked that before.
That's just the perfect answer. I love stumping the guest, but this is the thing, because you always talk about how to not focus on differences. So I'm curious how you use what's unique about yourself to make an impact or a difference.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess what, you know, I feel it's a little over. I don't want to be too self-promotional, but I sort of feel like I think what I'm best at, I've always found, is being able to take complex ideas and make them simple and digestible and understandable for people. And I feel that that's something that I am actually uniquely good at. And I try to do that as much as I can in every area, whether it's speaking on a podcast, whether it's writing a Harvard Business Review article, whether it's writing a book, whether it's writing academic articles. I try my best or consulting. I try my best to, and I think I'm pretty good at, in my difference, in a sense, using my difference to make a difference, is to be able to really get to the heart of something that can be pretty complex, and to present it in a way that is really understandable for people so that they can actually take action.
No, I think that's good. You help break things down to simple way, and you, I can definitely attest to this when I read your articles, is that you make it so, you always talk about experiential, you put us right there, you give us, you know, right examples that we can actually use, and you make it applicable to our everyday lives. So I think it's a skill. That's definitely a skill. Where can we find out more about you, your book, your articles, you know, other things you're doing?
Yeah, so I don't know. Maybe you'll post some information,
yep.
But I've got a webpage. I've got the Amazon page to Global Dexterity, which is my book. I've got my LinkedIn. I'm happy to, you know, connect with people on Twitter, of course, on Twitter. So lots of different places, all the typical places.
All right. I know. I'll make sure I put all this in the show notes for sure. So it'll be your LinkedIn, Twitter, links, and links to the book. So. And we'll make sure we get more people, you know, onto what you're doing, and hopefully, you know, get more people culturally aware about the world.
That's awesome. And Ted, this is actually a great conversation. I've done a lot of podcasts, but this is definitely one of my favorites. So thank you.
Well, hey, thanks. That's great. That's high praise coming from you. So I appreciate you coming on and spending some time. I know you're pretty busy. So thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
You've just been listening to the As Told by Nomads podcast. For more ways to use your difference to make a difference, as well as for show notes, head over to www.uidmag.com. Till next time, go out and make an impact in your world.